second, it seems to be frozen. No, it's gone. It's good. Yes, those are the sheets. We actually, for some reason, I had in my mind that you weren't going to be here. So the last subject that I have is the first subject on the list, but I think it probably pays referring to. And we should probably start by reading EO, sort of catch up where we were. We were in the middle of chapter 3.
The reason that we might not have been here was that we had a little girl instead of a little boy in California.
Mazel tov.
Little girl, we got a little slack there.
Oh, very nice. Mazel tov, very nice. Good to hear. I wanted me to make a depression.
Did you know when it was going to happen?
No.
Well, I don't mean to get depressing, but it's EO, so there's not much we can do about it when it comes to it's a real Simcha light browser. So we were at, we had just finished the cursing of the day and the cursing of the night. So that brings us to verse 10. And that's really where he ends off. He's talking about cursing his day, cursing his night, wishing he was never born. And it ends, it's hard to say where the section ends or begins, but it looks like it ends with verse 10 because of the word ki, which means ki lo sagar dalte vitni, that the doors of my stomach were not closed. Now, by beten, he means womb. He means a womb here, not a stomach.
Because it did not block my mother's womb.
Right. Now, what's interesting about the JPS is we're in chapter 3, verse 10. Now, what's really interesting here is that it puts in an extraneous word. That is, the English... So the JPS puts in the word mother. That is, my mother's womb was not closed. And the reason why it puts that in is because something seems to be missing from this verse. It says, Ki lo sagar dalte vitni vayaster amame enai, which means because the walls of vitni is not my mother's stomach, it's my stomach. But Eov doesn't have a womb, and if he had a womb, it wouldn't make much sense if he did, because he's talking, referring to himself as a baby. What he's saying is that the way to simply interpret it is to say that he's talking about that his mother's womb is his womb, in the sense like my kids have a room. If I ask my kids about the room in their house, it's my house, I pay for it, but they say this is my room. So, in a simple sense, that's what
that's
he means.
The womb that he
owns.
But
so
I think it hinges on the next one, because why didn't I die in that womb? Why didn't I perish there? And that might be why he's referring it to his womb.
Because he's referring to it as a place where he can die?
Right, where he resided, and why didn't he die there?
Like right.
Exactly.
Although you could still say my mother's womb and then say why didn't I die in that womb? That is, you don't necessarily have to cut the mother out from the scenario in order to make that point. But let's continue on with the verses and take a look and see exactly the point. Well, cut her out from the start. It's like those famous things where the authors cut their, if they don't like somebody, they cut you right out of the story.
He's gone through a lot of suffering.
Yeah. This is post-suffering.
It's not mother's fault.
Yeah. Well, actually, we'll find out something interesting. He doesn't accuse his mother of everything, but there is something interesting going on here. There's an interesting subject.
I'm sorry, which pasuk are we?
We're in verse 10. I'm going to read verse 10 again.
No wonder I couldn't find it.
Kilosagar dalte vitni vayaster amal me'enai. And amal was hidden from my eyes. Now keep in mind what you're supposed to do there. We discussed a little bit about biblical parallelism. You're supposed to put the words lo in front of the second stick. So it really it would read like this in full on poetic form. It would read kilo sagar dalte vitni kilo satar amal me'enai. That is, so that amal was not closed from my eyes. The word satar, and the word seter, was secreted away. Vayaster, it was secreted away. Amal me'enai, amal from my eyes. Now, there's two problems I want to deal with. I want to leave the word amal. It's a difficult word because it's not clear exactly what he's saying here, and I find it interesting. The word amal seems to be simple, but I think it's not so simple. But I want to skip on to get back to the issue of his womb. So to do that, we need to continue with the next few verses. Lama lo mirechem amut? Why did I not die in the womb? Mibeten yatsati ve'egva. I should have come out of the womb and died, va'egva, from the word gvia, a corpse. I should have been a corpse as soon as I came out, a stillborn. Madua kidmuni virkayim. So he's taking it step by step. That is, why didn't I die in the womb? That's the first stick of number 11. In the second stick, it says, all right, and if I came out, I should have come out as a corpse. If that's not good enough, we get to verse 12, which is Madua kidmuni virkayim. Now, kidmunim is, why were knees forwarding me? Why were they forwarding me on their knees? Which means, apparently, what happened in the womb situation, hi, good evening, what happens in the womb is after the birth, is what they would do is they probably take the baby, and much like we wrap it in the blankets, I suppose, to keep it warm, sort of to... it's not too distant from today. If you think about the birth situation, the baby comes out, it's wrapped and warmed up these days, and then it's put back right on top of the mother, not in the mother's lap. We think more of the mother's.
Well, isn't there an idiom? Didn't Rachel, when she gave Bilha to Yaakov, say Bilha would bear on her knees on Rachel's knees?
And isn't it because in those days they did not lie down, they stooped to have their babies?
Could
so
have
they
been.
Were on
so they were already sitting anyway.
In a sitting or stooping situation, and it's a more natural way to give birth.
It's very possible. I don't know. Where Job chapter 3, verse 11. I want to take a look and see whether the Birkayim thing. I didn't think about it. Let's take a look at Vayetze and see if that's right. Where do you think that's from? Yes. And I'll tell you what that means in this case. Yeah, I think you're right, and I'll tell you what it means there and here. Well, let's read it. It's in Vayetze, so let's say chapter 29 in Genesis, if you have it, or chapter 30. I shall read it to you as soon as I find it.
Wow, yeah.
Just a second. Chapter 30, probably. There's Yisachar.
What?
We're looking in Genesis chapter 29, I think.
He's already gone.
Okay. This is what she gets very upset. That's chapter 30. So in chapter 30, it says, here it is. Chapter 30, verse 3. Vatomer, and she said, this is Rachel speaking, after Yaakov gets angry at her. Hine amati bilha boi leho vateled al birkai, and she shall give birth on my knees. Va'ibanen, I will become built up, gamanochi mimena. So I think the idea was that you would create a sort of connection. There may have even been a wet nurse issue here, but I'm not entirely sure. That is, you needed to make a connection between the child and the person that would be nursing the child. So what you would do is, I think you would take the child and sort of place it on the knees of the person that would be its mother, that would help it nurse and come to life. They use birkayim, perhaps because they were saying that as opposed to laying down, but there's a similar image. Mm-hmm. So what's going on is madua kidmuni birkayim, which means how come the knees, or they forwarded me to the knees. The word kidmuni, like kedem, which is forward, like kadimo, and you say kadima, which is forward. By the way, kedem is east, of course, right? If you don't think of kedem, so why is kedem east? Mizrach is also east, right? So how come Kedem and Mizrach are both east? Mizrach is from a sun standpoint, right, where the sun shines, Zarach HaShemesh, and Ma'arav HaShemesh, which is where the sun goes down. But if you look at it from a historical perspective, Harare Kedem is the mountains that we Jews came from as we look to the east. And what do you call Hayam? What's another name for the Mediterranean? You know, it's called Yam Ha'acharon, right? Why? Kidmuni Yam Ha'acharon is what it's called. Yam Ha'acharon doesn't mean the last sea.
The one behind me.
And what that really means is Acharon was another term for west. Kidmuni Kedem is east, because that's the way I face towards my history. And Yam Acharon is where, you know, behind me. That's a very ancient kind of idea, that I'm always looking towards my past. I mean, we as Jews kind of automatically inculcate that into our knowledge. That is, we're always looking toward, we always believe that the best generation was the one closest to Har Sinai, and we're always a step away from that. It's a very non-modern idea, but if you go back to ancient literature, you'll find that's exactly how they all felt about it. That is, the ancient times were those were the times of heroes. Those were the times of the, you know, Gilgamesh, they barely even knew. He was a new guy, but the stories, Gilgamesh was considered to be, you know, the pièce de résistance of rulers, even though he, you know, he's probably just some guy. So people always tend to make heroes out of their past. It's a Jewish idea. I don't think I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad idea, but it is interesting that the word kedem, meaning east, because that's the way we face, and achor, meaning west. So you have various, and by the way, so you have kedem and achor, and then on your right, what do you have? Oh, so then if kedem is my east and achor is my back, meaning my west, then if I'm working by directions, then what's south then called if I'm facing from west to east? It's called Yamina. What's another name for south? Teiman.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
So now when Avram says the im Yamina, the im Teim, what does he say? Im Smola Asmiila. Sorry, im Yamina Asmiila. Im Asmiila Emina. What that means is, if you go north, I'll go south. If you go south, I'll go north, because he's facing that away. Mm-hmm. Of course, Yosef, Lot didn't want to go either way. He wanted to go straight ahead, which was to stone, but that's a separate issue. So that's really where these ideas come from. So Madua Kidmuni Birkayan. So why did these knees bring me to life? Which means, okay, so I'm born alive right now, but put me in a sack and forget about me, and I'll die quick enough. And then next step, Umashadayim Ki Inak. And what, or Ma in this case is short for Lama. Ulama Shadayim, why should there be breast? Ki Inak, that I should be able to nurse. So he takes you through, beautifully actually, through the four stages of how he could have died if only they would have left him alone. One is, he could have died in the womb as a miscarriage. The second one is, he could have died as a stillborn. The third is, he could have died by having him come out and nobody would have taken care of him. And the fourth one is, they would have stopped feeding him and that would have taken care of it as well. As you can see, he's not happy, to say the least. Kiata. What's that?
The note in this
go ahead, please.
Note is that the knees of the father on whom the child was laid as a mark of acceptance and legitimation.
Okay. it's okay.
Someone is a bris also, very often.
Yeah, I see this in terms of death, though, rather than in terms of acceptance. He's asking for death here. He's not saying, I would have been happy if they would have made me a non-wanted child and I would have wandered the streets. I think he's saying,
with that, but the custom was, he's saying, why was I put on he doesn't mention his father's knees, but on the knees, if the custom was to put the child on the knees.
I'm wondering if the note there is focused. The simple textual comparison, I think, is the one that we mentioned before, which was the knees that was when Rachel comes, as you said, when Rachel came and said that, the babies will be born on my knees, so it sounds like the mother is more connected with that. The note may be confused by the fact that the mother is not mentioned here, and that's a point that I want to revisit. Because in none of these places, if you take a look, the rechem has no owner. The beten is my beten, if it has any owner. The birkayim have no owner. It doesn't say birkayimi, and one would have expected that, and I suspect that's why the note is probably searching for something else. Umashadayim ki inak. It's also why. I mean, it's like what? It's very like, I don't want to say anything that's inappropriate, but it's like they don't disconnected really. There's no mother involved. It's like, you know, these are cold body parts that have no possession and ownership. Let me read one more verse, and then I'll speak about that a little bit. Ki atasha chavdi veeshkot, so that now I could be lying and silent, which means dead. Yashanti, if I go to sleep, azya nuachli, then I'll have some peace. So he's saying, listen, now I'm alive, so atasha chavdi, so now what I'll do is I'll lie down and I'll die. Yashanti, and if I go to sleep, and I think he means to sleep as in Hamlet's sleep, right? He means to sleep, perchance, to dream. Azya nuachli, it will be good for me. Now here's where I want to show you this sheet, which I think is of note. At the very type, there's Yirmiyahu, Perichot. Now, Yirmiyahu's got one of the most miserable lives in Tanakh.
Mm.
And there's a part where he's wishing he wasn't born. And take a look at the words. It's fascinating. Arur hayom asher yiladati bo. Cursed is the day that I was born on, which is exactly like Eov.
Mm-hmm.
Yom asher yiliditani imi, the day which my mother gave birth to me, al yihi varuch, let it not be blessed. Arur ha'ish asher baser et avi lemor. Cursed be the man who came over to my father saying, Yalad lecha ben zachar, you had a baby boy. Samach samcheyu. Go be happy. Go have a nice time. Now, we didn't do this week. We did it last week. That was the first part of the chapter where he's cursing the day that he's born. And he's cursing the tale that he was born. But he never curses the person who told the tale, Eov. Here, the person who tells the tale, the father's there and the mother's there. Vaya ishahu. You know what? It's hard for me to read without nikudot. Let me open it up with nikudot. Yirmiyahu perchav. I don't want to misread it. Oh, not Yirmiyahu. I'm okay with Bereshit, but yeah, I'm sorry. I wish I had a program that would cut and paste in the kudot on my computer at home. Unfortunately, I don't have that capability. What verse is this? Verse 14. Arur hayom asher yuladti vo, the day that I was born. Yom asher yuladatni imi al yehi varuch. Let not be blessed. Arur ish. Cursed be the person asher bisar et avili mor, who told the story to my father. Yuladacham ben zachar sameach simchahu. V'haya ishahu ke'arim asher hafach Hashem v'lo nicham. Let that person be like the cities which have been destroyed and God has no mercy on. V'shama zakah v'boker utra be'etzarayim. And that you hear nothing but cries of war in the morning and the blowing of the shofar at night.
All he did was say,
yeah, that's right. So you have to be careful. Now you know.
How are you? I'm
afraid
you get an answer.
Asher lo motatani mirachem. That they did not kill me from the womb, but tehi li imi kivri, my mother should have been my grave. What is he saying? He's saying I should have died in a thing, and my mother should have been my grave. Virachma and her womb, virachma, rachem shala, harat olam should have been. In this case, yom harat olam.
Yeah,
like the eternal birthplace. Virachma harat olam.
Well, in other words, yeah,
that is it would have been my permanent
one.
Right. It would have been my permanent. It would have been a pregnancy that never ended. Let's say. Lama zemi rechem yatzati. They wrote amal v'yagon, that I should have seen amal v'yagon v'yichlu v'voshet yamai, and my days would end in shame. What's interesting here? The words are really quite parallel. And of course, Eov, if it was written afterwards, certainly knows the words of Yirmiyahu, or they may have been written pretty contemporaneously. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, though, is Yirmiyahu is a sad, lonely guy, but he's not alone. He feels bad. He wishes he wasn't born, but he has people around him. When he thinks back of his childhood, he sees his mother, he sees a father, he sees a walking dog,
yeah, well,
a guy walking in. That's
these.
Correct.
These are not without form as these are.
Without anybody,
yeah,
possessing
without,
them.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And that's why, I think that's why it says Kimuni Birkaim as opposed to Kimuni Birkeimi. It's not that we're, I think it's, not, it could be the notes right, but it's, I don't think it's that the father is trying to, that the father is trying to be included to the exclusion of the mother. Everybody is excluded here. Mm-hmm. There's no mention of mother, there's no mention of father, there's no mention of the person who told the story. There is just objects floating in the air. There's a womb, and there's breasts, and there's knees, and none of them have possession. I think what he's trying to describe, because I think the author knows that we know the passage in Yirmiyahu, and not only that, probably the passage in Yirmiyahu is probably a pretty well-known passage. I can't believe Yirmiyahu is the first guy who said, I wish I died in my mother's in my mother's womb. It was probably a reasonably common. We have similar comments like that today, and I assume back then they probably had also similar comments. But I suspect that all the comments that were back then were never divorced from the ownership of the fact that one had a mother and father. Eov might as well have been spawned from the earth, as lonely as he feels. And perhaps, I don't know for sure, I've always been curious about the wife that shows up. Remember the wife that shows up at the end of chapter 2 and says, why don't you just curse God and die? And he gets very angry at her and says, Lama tadaberi kechadan, stop talking, kechadan nevalim anevalot tadaberi. You're talking like one of the terrible women. It doesn't really, to my mind, really help the story at all. What do we need? We don't really need her as a protagonist, especially because she doesn't show up later. He has more kids at the end of the story. We have no idea whether it's from her or for not her. We don't really have that. What we know is about the kids. My suspicion, it's just a suspicion, no way to prove this, is that may have been added there to show that the wife hadn't died. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe if the wife died, then you couldn't have satisfied the story. The author still has to live within a certain sense of the story. But he creates this tension where even when he goes to his wife for a little bit of support and help, she just says, why don't you go and die? And now he's all alone. He's got no kids. He's got no money. He's
got
no wife he could talk to. What's that?
He's got these three.
You're right, that's all he has, and we'll find out they're not much friends. You're right, and we spoke about that last week. Every time he tries to kick them out of the house, and the minute they're about to walk out the door, he tells them to come back, which means he's not quite as lonely as he would. As lonely as he is, there's always worse. He's something of a big talker sometimes, Eof. He's something of a big talker. Yes.
That kind of thing, I'm sure.
Human nature, somebody needs to
say these things, and they're not really so anxious to be dead, even though they're talking like...
You see this in kids a lot. The kids fall down, they hurt themselves, they look around, they start to cry, nobody's around.
No.
Then they run over to their parents' house and they start to cry. I think that's probably built into human nature, and I suspect it's part of Eof's human nature as well, because the book is well in tune with human nature.
Talking about that last comment, could that be why the wife is brought in at this point? Because to show that deep down he really never lost at all? Because this just puts a context to everything else he's going to say about, I wish I were never born.
He could go that way. I would have said that it's more, once the woman tells her husband that she's really going to die, and he tells her that he should feel for him.
I mean, that's what he's saying. He wishes he was never alive. So she's telling him to sin.
But she's saying sin. Barech Elohim. She says, blaspheme God and die, which means her pinnacle, you know, you always want, in the end, you want to be able to go home and your wife will tell you to go daven ma'ariv. You know, that. So it's absolutely necessary. Otherwise, you're really not going to go nearly as much. If your wife don't say, go daven ma'ariv, you ain't going to go so much. So here he comes over to his house, his wife, and says, what should I do? And she said, you should curse God and then die. The ball game's over. And I think that creates more sense of loneliness than I'm having things. But I mean, this is pretty much speculation. Even what I'm doing here is speculation, but it is very striking that all of these body parts are completely without possession. And I think that's very bad. The only one who possesses any of the body parts is the woman. That's his, not his mother's.
Isn't the wife also part of that? I mean, she's without possession too. I mean, his wife, but she doesn't act like a wife.
Yeah, that's correct. That is, she doesn't act as religious support.
She also lost all her kids.
She is certainly a foil. The story, I believe, is to a certain degree invented. The parts of the story are invented. They're invented to make the point. So she's there as a character actor. How exactly she was seen when she came on the stage. And by the way, I mentioned this at one point. I had mentioned when we spoke about the way that it's done in poetry, that I expected that these things were done in a play. I suspect that was the goal. And you should know there's something to that even in our Tanakh. I think it's not just an idea that this was written specifically for presentation. Seven sons and three daughters, 7,000 cow and 3,000 this. I think these things are they're epic, they're dramatic. There is an idea of this in Tanakh, of course, because if you remember when David, Yoav wanted... Yoav wanted to get David to take his son Absalom back. Absalom had committed murder. He exiled Absalom, and he knew that David was upset about Absalom. So, what? At the end, but at first he was exiled, and then Yoav wants to bring him back. So what do they get? They get a woman to dress up, and she puts on this whole play acting thing. You remember the story? She puts on the whole play acting thing about how I had two sons, and one son committed a sin, and the other son's going to kill him, and I'm going to have nothing, and what should I do? Yada, yada, yada. It's all a sad story. And what is she called? This whole presentation, she dresses up, and she's in clothes, and she puts on this whole fakery thing. In the end, David figures it out, but it's really quite a convincing play. What is she referred to? She's referred to as an Isha Chachama. What does it mean by a wise woman? There were these skills. It was acting, actually. She was a thespian, and that was part of the whole Chachama business, and therefore to see Eof as a play, I think, is not beyond the realm of, I think, even it has some textual support from Sefer Shmuel or from other places.
I guess just one more question. The text where his wife came into the picture ends with Barech Elokim Vameit.
Yeah.
Barech is blaspheme?
It's blaspheme because it's what's called a Lashon Sagi Nahor. They don't want to say Mekalel Hashem Vameit, so they change it to Barech Elohim, bless God, but it means the exact opposite.
Okay. You know, you can also see that sometimes people get disgusted, like, if he's always complaining, I wish I had died, I wish I had died, that she might say, so then go ahead, die. You know, like, it doesn't sound like a very comforting woman, but it's still sometimes people...
Just done out of despair.
Yeah, you know, like
I'm
they keep complaining, yeah, all right, cool.
Was
you want to die, die,
too.
Right, that, it does fit into the text. The only thing that it has a little problem with is Eov's sharp response. Eov says, Lama ad medaber kechata nevalot tedaberi. What, hatov lokim ka... We take the bad from God, will we take the good from God, won't we take the good? There seems to be a religious issue at hand, rather than just a natural husband-wife setting. I'm saying it's impossible, but Eov certainly believes that she is giving up the religion. She feels that she's really had quite enough for religion. If we don't get nice things,
then check out.
Well, right, right. And how many people have given up religion for the same reason? I think there's a reason why there's a sefer Eov. I think so. Even though it's so hard to read. All right, so let's get on to the two words that I want to take a look at, and then hopefully we'll finish the parak today. I'll skim some of it, but it's so beautiful it's hard to miss. So in verse 10 it says, Kilosagar dalte vitni vayaster amal meinai. Now the word amal is very interesting. What is amal? If you had to do a blind read of the word amal, what does amal sound like?
Isn't it work?
Work or trouble, and you probably know that from Kohelet. So if you take kol amal asher amalo tachat ha-shemesh, right, all the hard work that he does. Amal is used in Kohelet mostly for the sake of hard work and trouble. And therefore what he seems to be saying is, ki lo sagar dalte vitne vayaster amal me'enai, and that the troubles or the hard work should be hidden from my eyes. Okay. It's an interesting idea. The only problem is if you skip ahead to chapter 4, don't lose your place because we're bouncing back. This is Eliphaz speaking. And Eliphaz is responding that, hey, only sinners get punished. And that if you're not a sinner, you'll come out clean. So if you take a look at verse 7. Zechorna, please remind me. It doesn't mean remember. It means you remind me. Zechorna, mihu naki avad. Who is the person who was clean of sin who got destroyed? Well, it's a rhetorical question. It means nobody who ever did wonderful things ever got destroyed. Ve'efo yisharim nichadu. And show me where righteous people get turned upside down, get lied to. Kasher ra'iti chorshe aven. When I saw people who sow, l'chrosh means to plow sin, right? Aven is sins. The zorei amal, and those who sow amal, yiktseruhu, they will be cut down. So here we have your classic biblical poetry, and the word amal, zorei is clearly parallel to chorshe, right? Sown to plow, and therefore amal is parallel to the word aven. And aven is sin, which means amal is sin. And if you take a look at your sheets, let's take a look at Bamidbar. This is, by the way, keep in mind that wherever we do something from Bamidbar, we're doing something from the Bilam story. Keep in mind the Bilam story, according to Chazal, Bilam was written by Moshe, just like Eov was written by Moshe. Now, if you don't want to say that Eov was specifically written by Moshe, one thing Chazal may have meant, and we're certainly right about even if they didn't mean it, which was that it was written in the style of Moshe. That is, Bilam is the paradigm upon which Sefer Eov is written, and we'll do that sometimes. Many of the mashalim that show up in Sefer Bilam, which is the Bilam parable, which is the chapter 22 or so in Bamidbar, show up in Eov as well. They are stylistically very, very similar books. And take a look at what it says in Bamidbar. You probably remember this. This is Matovu Alecha Yaakov. And what does he say? Lo hibit aven biyakov. God did not see or witness sin in Yaakov, v'lo ra'ah amal b'Yisrael. There's your parallelism. Once again, amal is connected to aven. What does Rashi say? Amal lashon, you see it? Aveira. Amal is aveira. Lefi sheha aveirahi, because sin is an amal lefnei amakom. It's a burden to God. So he connects the idea of burden with not our burden, but the burden of God. But either way you want to play games, the pasuk is irrefutable here. Amal means sin. It does not mean hard work. It doesn't mean I never saw the Jews working hard. It means I never saw the Jews sinning.
But Rashi doesn't use amal as sin.
Yes. He says, amal lashon avera. You see that?
Right. But then it says,
And then he's listening on the, he's trying to explain how we could use the word amal, which is well known as he's doing a little bit of etymology here. He wants to know how the word amal, which clearly in Kohelet means hard work, could also mean sin. So he's saying that we commit sin, it's hard work for God, it's a pain and trouble for God. That's all fine and good. He's explaining the etymology of the word amal is sin, but the bottom line is amal is sin. Amal is not hard work. And therefore, there's a little bit of a translation problem here in Eov. Now, I don't want to go into all these details, but if we look, and there are many cases of amal where you could find this pain, suffering, and hard work. So the question that we have when we read Eov is, first of all, in Eov I showed you in chapter 4, amal meant specifically sin. So now I got chapter 3, and now I got two ways to interpret this verse, I believe. Kilo sagar dalte vitne vayaster amal me'enai, and I would not see sins. Now, I'm not clear exactly what he's talking about. That is, what is he begging? Amal doesn't quite fit in, because amal usually is hard work. Amal doesn't usually indicate just pain. It usually indicates the pain and suffering that comes with hard work. That doesn't exactly fit it. He didn't get nailed because of the hard work. He got nailed because of sort of, you know, extra things that just sort of came down. Amal might be sinning here, but that doesn't really fit either. I don't know, how does the English deal with the with these issues? How does your we have four or five different English ones. Your troubles?
Nor hide trouble from my eyes.
Verse 10, also
nor
troubles?
Hid trouble from mine eyes.
Yeah.
You have troubles also?
Here's his misery.
And hide trouble from my
eyes. Well, trouble is misery.
And hide trouble from my
eyes. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I have to tell you, I'm not entirely sure. Not only that, I think I had a Tehillim here. Do I have it here? Oh, I didn't bring it down.
Yes.
That was something. The Tehillim's at the bottom, though. That doesn't have the Amal business. There was a Tehillim in Amal where Amal is specifically used in sin. It's the same thing. Lo yirah enai Amal, which also seems to be indicating sin. I'm not clear about it, to be honest. I know everybody's translated trouble, but I'm not clear. And it may change what's going on. But if we take a look at something interesting, if you flip on to verse... I'm sorry, mentioning. If you flip on to verse 20, look at verse 20. Chapter 3, verse 20.
Right.
What does it say? It says, Lama yitain le'amel or v'chayim le'mare nafesh. Now here we know exactly what an amel is, because it's being parallel to what? To mare nafesh, the misery soul. So here it clearly means misery. However, one should take a look at the difference between the spelling. Lama yitain le'amel, or to a person who has this suffering, and take a look back in verse 10, vayaster amal. In the case of amal, it's a noun. Amel, it is a type of person, a person who contains a certain attribute. So therefore, I would caution one in trying to figure out one from the other, because there's two different spellings. They indicate two different things. They're not necessarily the same thing. And here is where we have another one of those possibilities that we did a little bit last week. It could be that he's saying both. Well, we'll see many times that Eov seems to be using words which are specifically vague to get both points across, which means I don't want to see my suffering and I'm sick and tired of seeing all the sinners. Why might that be important? Because what we don't know about Eov yet is that he is the chieftain of he's the chief shofet of his tribe. All of his tribe people come to him, and we'll see him complaining about the fact that now he sits on his tribal seat to judge people, and they all run away from him.
Yeah.
So,
What do you mean by light?
Oh, the light of day.
Light of day.
Yeah, light of day. And in fact, just because I want to be able to finish up stuff, I just wanted to raise this interesting issue. There's one other word that I want to take a look at, which is we were last on verse 14. Let's jump back to 14. That's where he says that he goes to the various stages that a child could die, and he wishes he was all of those. And in verse 13, he said, now that I haven't died that way, I wish I could die now. And then verse 14, he says something very interesting. Im malachim v'yoatzei aretz, with the kings and with the advisors of the land, habonim charavot lamo, who build destroyed places, right? Choreva, like ha'ir nechrevet, who build destroyed places for themselves, Oim Sarim Zahav Lahem, or with the officers, the officers who have lots of gold, Hamimalim Bateyem Kasef, who fill up their houses with silver. At this point, we have no idea what he's talking about. Like, what does this have to do with death? I have no clear what he means. And now he clearly goes into death, because he says, O Kenefel Tamun Lo Eheyeh, Or I wish I were not like, what he really means is ken ehyeh, I wish I was like a nephel tamun. So a nephel is a stillborn, right? A nephel tamun, and tamun means hidden. So the assumption is he's talking about a baby that was born dead and it was buried under the ground. Ke'olalim, like children, lo ra'u or, that never saw the light of day. Shamr sha'im chad lu roges, that's where the evil will stop their roges, is when you shake, which means all the things that they do, they're sinning. V'sham yanuchu yigei koch. You recognize these words? V'sham yanuchu yigei koch. I don't know if you knew that. See, it's interesting. We always sing it in a very happy way. V'sham yanuchu yigei koch. I'm not sure how many people know it comes from... what? Which is fine, but Sham Yanuchu Yigei Koch doesn't come from the pasuk comes from here, which is about people who are tired that they should die. So the pasuk, the way we sing it, does not really mean it what it originally means. What it originally means before we call being goal a pasuk. We took a pasuk which was referring to a very bad thing and we turned it to a very nice thing. I don't know if it, I didn't want to ruin the song for anybody, but I have to say the original meaning of the song is not so positive. Sham Yanuchu Yigei Koch does not mean where the Yonah lands his feet. It means the grave is what it means. Shamer Sha'im Chal Rogez V'Sham, in the grave, Yanuchu Yigei Rekoch, that's where the people who are tired will rest. Now let's stop there and now take a look at the verses. First of all, if you remember, I said the word Amal, it wasn't clear that he wasn't talking about sin. Now, since the whole chapter doesn't seem to be talking about sin, it seems to be talking about his pain, that seems to be coming out of the blue. The only problem is all of a sudden he seems to be saying, Shamer Sha'im Chal Rogez, that's where sinners should stop sinning. So here, once again, sort of at both sides of this little poetry, we have sinners on the top side and sinners on the bottom side. I still don't know exactly what it means, but I want to raise the possibility that Amal is not as simple as it seems. Now let's talk about the Malachim. So what is he talking about with the Malachim? So here you have to know something, which you probably do know, about Egyptian society. The reason why we know so much about ancient Egypt, even dating back to essentially middle of the third millennium, we're talking about who we call Cheops now. Now we call him Cheops, although his real name was Khufu, and others at that time. We're talking about the year of, you're really talking going back to the year 2000, really before Avram. How come we know so much about Cheops and about Sansoret, his father? How come we know about, how come there's so much history about them? Because the pyramids. And what were the pyramids built for?
Yeah.
They were built to death. And actually, what's interesting is that was the second dynasty, if I'm not mistaken. The second dynasty, they invented this whole idea of building these massive structures, although it exists in the first dynasty also. But here what they did is each following pharaoh would attempt to build a bigger and greater structure, massive structures. But it wasn't just the massive structure, you should know. There was the massive structures are connected to temples. And the temples were housed by people after their death. For every king they died, they would have hundreds of people, besides all the slaves that were required to build a grave. It's called the zero-sum economy, you know what I'm saying? I don't want to compare it to, like, Kolel, but it's a little bit, I don't want to say, I've got a trouble. I'll have to record that out, but it's a little bit like, well, the money just goes in and never comes out. It's a zero-sum economy. You don't build irrigation structures, you're not building places for people to work. I'm taking, essentially, you should know, during Cheops' time, they estimate about one-tenth of the population was used to build that pyramid. A humongous amount of people to build this massive structure. So not only was the structure of no use whatsoever, except the fact that it was a grave, it was to glorify the movement of the pharaoh, who was the living god, into the eternal afterlife, as a continuing to live god, but in the afterlife. And it wasn't just the pyramid. You had these massive structures. You take a look, if you take a look at books, I don't know if everybody wants to really go to Egypt these days, but if you take a look at books of pyramids, you'll notice that they only focus on the pyramid. Look at the entire site. It's this massive walled area, which is around the pyramid. First of all, there are usually some pyramids for the wives, little tiny pyramids for the wives outside of the walls. Inside the walls, you would have burial places for the viziers and others, and then they would also have working temples that would continue forever. Each king who died got his own cult, and they would have to have food, and they would have to have water and drink. So then you'd have the peasants working around this area. They found cultivated land where all the food goes to feed the clergy, and the clergy are doing nothing but feeding a dead person. That's all they're doing. They're giving sacrifice to a dead person. For every dead king, you had the structure, you know, which, you know, prices would soar into the billions, and not only at the building time, but continuation. Eventually, more and more money gets taken into this death process. The pyramids get larger and larger. What?
Keeping the people working.
Keeping the people working for nothing, because there's nothing to be gained from it, because the food doesn't go out. The food goes directly into the temple. Yeah. And this is, scholars, they believe that this is what brought down the Second Dynasty, which was an incredibly powerful dynasty. I mean, look at what they built. So how did such an incredible pharaonic dynasty destroyed? The same way most nations get destroyed, which is they run out of cash. They self-destruct. Exactly right. Not that they get attacked from the outside. It's that somebody wakes up today and says, hey, I'm in deficit. And what am I going to do about it? Can't take down the temples. They're important. That's the beef. What do they call that? That's the pork. Can't take down the temples. Because Lord knows if I take down his temple, forget about my temple. Forget about, besides the fact that they felt quite religious about it. They were very seriously religious. Egypt always was. They pretty much had the same religion for thousands and thousands of years. And they weren't really interested in strangers picking it up. As opposed to other religions that always tried to proselytize, the Egyptians were happy to do their thing and you can mind your own business. They were very religious people, but it was a death religion. It was a death religion. The story of Osiris and Horus, his son, right? Osiris dies and then Horus is reborn out of the ashes. All of that is Egyptian. It's a death cult. It is really what most of it's about. Until Ray, maybe a little bit later on, so maybe it got some certain facets of life, but by and large, it was a death cult. That's what people feared. That's what they make their religion. So now let's take a look at what Eov is talking about. Now it's quite clear. Imlachim v'yotzei aretz habonim charavot lamo, who build places of destruction for themselves or destroy places for themselves. You know what he's talking about? He's talking about the death cities, which means he's saying that I should die just like, let me die, just like all those rich, rich kings. They're all rich and they all made these beautiful things, but the bottom line is they're in charavot. They're in graves. And now look at the next line. Oim sarim zahav lahem. All the princes that had sahim, zahav, hamimalim batehem kesef. They fill up their money with houses. They fill up their houses with money. Now you might think it's talking about a miser, but I don't think so. I think what it's talking about is like the famous Tutankhamun stuff. Why is Tutankhamun so famous? Because the amount of riches they found in his house, i.e., in the place where he was buried. They put the money away for the future life. They took all that famous money, all those riches, and the bottom line is they stuck it away so they could take it with them. Now today, well, some people try to still take it all with them, but it's less common. But back then, the culture was you don't give it to your kids, you take it with you so that you have a nice life in the afterlife. Yeah. And that's what he's referring to. And now let's look in the next pasuk, and now it all makes sense. Oh, kenefel tamun lo hayah, or I'll be like the stillborn. And what he's essentially saying is, it doesn't matter. It's all death, don't you see? You could be rich and I'll die with them, and you could be poor and stillborn. The bottom line is everybody goes to the same place, and that's what he's saying. Whether you're rich, you're poor, you're all, in the end, it's all, you're all worm food.
Isn't
is what he's saying.
He's very parallel to Kohelet.
What's that?
In this concept.
Yeah. There's similarities, and God willing, we'll do some of the similarities. There's similarities to Mishlei, Kohelet, and Tehillim, and we'll hopefully do some of them. Sham Rishaim Chadlu Rogez. That's where the evil will stop doing their evil. The Sham Yanuchu Yigei Koach, and those who apparently because it's biblical parallelism, you can't compare Rishaim to Yigei Koach. My guess is Yigei Koach are the people that the Rishaim were working on. You see what I mean? That is, the people who did evil and caused pain to others, they're going down there, and the people who had pain caused them, they're going down there as well. And that's what he's saying. He's pretty depressing, right? Yachad asirim sha'ananu. How do I know, by the way, how do I get this parallel from the Rishaim versus the Yigei Koach? Yigei Koach, by the way, the actual translation is not just somebody who's tired. Yigei Koach means somebody who has been oppressed and therefore has no strength left. The next pasuk emphasizes that. Yachad asirim sha'ananu. The people who have been captive will find their peace. Sha'anan is peace. Lo shamu kol noges. They will not hear the voice of a noges. Noges is the guy who cracks the whip. Taskmaster. Is that what it says there? That's a good translation. Yes. Good translation. Katon v'gadol shamhu. The old and the young. Here I don't think it means the old and the young. I think it means the great and the small. They're all the same. Which means, I think what he's trying to say is, they're all there. And now he's saying something which I'm going to speculate here, but I think it may be true. Ve'eved chofshi me'adonav. And a slave is free from his master. And I think this may have two connotations. One, just saying that, you know, even though you were a downtrodden slave, you should know the master's going to die, the slave's going to die, and that's it. I think it may take on some other meanings in the ancient Near East, which is as follows. I don't know if you know that kings tend to, when they die, their servants tend to die with them.
Yeah.
We have that actually in the old Babylonian dynasty of Sargon the Great. That's 2,300 years before the Common Era. He was the first one to really build what we call a Babylonian empire. It wasn't really a Babylonian empire. His capital city was Akkad and not Babel. Babel was Hammurabi about 500-600 years later, but we always refer to that area as Babylonian. So he didn't actually think he was a god. But his son, Shulgi, and another one, great-grandson, Naram-Sin, they thought they were gods. When they died, we have their burial sites. there are hundreds of servants who were killed with them, strangled. We have that. I mean, we not just one or two. In some cases, I don't know about hundreds, dozens and dozens of servants that bit it, and we know that they were killed. You could tell, I guess, I think from the way the neck is broken or whatever it is, that when the king goes, the Avadim would go with them, and Eov's living in that culture, and the author knows the culture of. Now, if we put this book later, Exilic Times, I'm not sure that was still done during Nebuchadnezzar's time. I'm not positive that was done. But I'm sure that the stories were well known about what happens to Avadim. So it's a little speculative. In the very simple sense, what he means is an Eved and a master, well, the bottom line is you take off the ranks off their sleeves and they're all the same thing. But I think he may be saying something even more powerful, was the Evadim will get taken down to the grave with their masters. The bottom line is they're all dead and there's nothing to talk about.
But maybe it also is trying to say that they have no more purpose in life. Once the king dies, you know, they have no purpose in life, so they should be dead too.
So you think it's the fact that the purpose is lost?
Yeah. The purpose of life was to serve the king. The king is dead, then they have no purpose in life.
They serve the next king.
Yeah, I don't want to disagree with that because it's certainly
part of the king's wealth, having a servant. Taking his wealth with him, his servants with him.
Right, that's
so
true.
When does the next king has wealth, though?
These servants, I suppose. The truth is, not every servant. Yeah, I have to say, what happened with Shulgi and with Naram Sin, those ancient children of Sargon the Great, very exceptional, because the people were smart enough to know that, you know, if you took all the servants with you, and if you took all the money with you, you really wouldn't have anything. Very few, they weren't that. Real, they weren't quite that dumb. It could be. I'm looking at this, though. I see whether it's with the great kings or whether it's with the stillborns. Either way, it's all the same thing. I see it more as a leveling of rank rather than a fact that everybody's purpose has run out. But it's certainly possible. Let's continue on. Lama Yitain Lamal Or. We're back to Pasuk Chaf where we were before. V'chayim L'mari Nafesh. Why? Now here, by the way, here this is a new idea. The previous pasuk was the end of a stitch. At the end of a section, Katon v'gadol shamhu v'eved chofshi matanav. End of story. And what he's really said from verse 10 to verse 19 is, it's all the same. Ultimately, who cares whether I was great or whether I was small? The bottom line is, everybody's going to die. That's not a comment against God. That's a fact. That's actually a very fair fact. I think it's a very reasonable fact. He hasn't criticized God yet. That's going to change now in verse 20. Here's where things get tough.
Isn't this also, I'm sorry to interrupt,
please.
Isn't this somewhat of a slap at the cult of the idea of the cult of the dead where they felt the ranks continued on?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Oh, yes, I believe that as a Jewish author, he's quite making fun of it, yes. And that doesn't mean, and that means that sometimes we look at his philosophy, Yov's philosophy, and say we have to reject that. Like, I don't believe that God's doing the right thing. But you have to be careful with Yov. There's a lot of wisdom stuff in here which can be found in Kohelet. Even in Kohelet, you have to reject some stuff. A lot of times when Kohelet says stuff, right, there are contradictions in Kohelet. Kohelet says everything's worth something and then nothing's worth anything. It's a very difficult book to work with. And maybe, God willing, some other day we'll do that.
Stages of his life.
Yeah, exactly right. That Kohelet was in the middle of life. He was still struggling with the whole issue.
Very, that's why it looks contradictory.
Yeah, there's another answer which is less... There's another answer which is also good, which is that, and it comes up here also a little bit, sometimes a book is quoting another book as a rejecting quote.
Mm-hmm.
That is, sometimes it says, and they say it's not worth anything, but I'll tell you, the only problem is in Tanakh you don't see the quote lines, you don't see the end of they said. I'll show you that in a case when we get to Eov, like in chapter 5 and chapter 6, where Eov contradicts himself from one verse to the other verse, and the best way, the way that the Shadal, or Shmuel David Latata says, is this is a quote. He's saying, there are those who say X, Y, Z, but I'm telling you it's not, it's A, B, C. And some of Kohelet could be understood that way also, and that takes some of the difficulty from the book, but that's a separate issue altogether. Lama Yitain Lamal Or V'chayim L'mari Nafesh. Now here is the first time that he's actually criticizing God. Why should he give to the suffering light? V'chayim L'mari Nafesh. Now he's not saying that you're hurting me because I didn't sin or sin. We haven't gotten to the issue of whether he was righteous or not righteous. He's just saying, if what your plans for me were to make me suffer, then what do you say this? So if you knew I was going to suffer, if it was all about suffering, which also gets to the issue of whether God knows what we'll do, whether we have free will or not free will. But aside that issue, what he's essentially saying is, if I'm just going to suffer, why give me life in the first place? Is this some kind of game? Is there some kind of trick here? I'd rather be dead than to suffer. It's better not to be than to be and to suffer. That's his philosophy. Whether that's correct or not, we have to think about it, but that's his philosophy here. Hamachakim lemaved ve'ineno, those who wait for death and they can't find it. Vayach peruha mimatmonim, they search it out like hidden treasures. By the way, here's a play on the word, you see the word matmonim in verse 21? Matmonim are hidden treasures, the word tamun. But we also saw that word back on verse 16, which was okin nefel tamun, like a stillborn that is buried under the ground. So there's a play on, there are puns and shades going on here. Because here he's talking about people who search the hidden treasure, but if you take it back there, the hidden treasure to him is to find himself somehow, like the fight, like one of those scary movies where the guy goes into the grave thing and he sees his own gravestone. It says like from 1947 to today. You know, that's it. I always told people, when I was a kid, I used to always be afraid of. I would never look at those. You know, in the shuls they always have those. And I was always be looking for my name. Always be afraid I'd see something like, you know, Eric Levy, 1967 to today. You know, always something. They didn't scare when you were a kid. They didn't scare you. They always scared the heck out of me. I always looked at them and tried to see if like there was somebody with my name who was born on the same day. You never did this. Obviously, I'm more morbid than most people.
Well, that was the plot line in Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. He finally turns around. He sees his gravestone.
Yeah.
Right.
I get in the paper every day. I read the obits. If my name isn't there, I get out of bed.
That's cool. When we were in Normandy walking in the cemetery, I heard a grave of somebody who died.
I didn't make it up, but
was it a Jewish fellow who died on your birthday in Normandy?
Oh, in Normandy, yeah.
Right, so you do look for. No, I'm not the only one.
No.
I'm not such a weirdo.
No.
So you're looking for similar dates and other.
Well,
we weren't looking. When we went to Normandy, we went to each of the Jewish graves.
What's that? Of the Jewish soldiers that fell there? Is that what it is?
Yes, Normandy.
I had no idea. I assumed that they got taken back to the United States.
That he was like 20 years old. He died on my birthday.
Wow.
And.
I was nine or ten years old at that time.
Statistically,
when this person died, and then just the fact that there I was on the same day.
Right.
And I'm happy to say the same thing is true. You take it easy, 25 people who died.
Right, I'm sure.
Shortly,
a lot of people died.
I'm just afraid we only have about 2 minutes left. I want to make sure that we finish this chapter. So he says, Hasmechim Ele Gil, verse 22. Now the word Ele is a little bit curious there. Ele means El, not Ele. Think of what we say on Shabbat. Ale Asor Va'ale Navel, Ale Higayom Achinor. That means Al, but rise up. But it's a fancy way of saying Al, say Ele. Here too, a fancy way of saying El is Ele. So Hasmechim Ele Gil, those who are happiness, who pursue happiness, those who are happy, El Gil, to the sake of Gil. Now normally when we think of Gil, we think of Gila, Rina, Dihitza, Vechedva, we think of happiness. But it's not always like that. If you take a look quickly in Eicha, what does it say? Kumi Roni Balaila. Right? You're familiar with that from Eicha. Which means normally we think of Rina as being happy, but that's not necessarily true. Kumi Roni Balaila. L'rosh Ashmurot, Shifti Kamayim, etc., etc. Roni haramat kol b'shir obinehi. So Gil and Rina, you should know in Tanakh, usually they are singing in happiness, but not always. The idea is I sing out and I cry out, sometimes in happiness, sometimes in sadness. Here again, he's using a word, hasmechim ele Gil, which could be understood in both ways. You'll find Gil being used cries of happiness and cries of unhappiness, and I think he's doing it as a sense of, I don't know what I'm looking for. I'm looking for my grave. I'm looking for my unhappiness, my eternal unhappiness. Yasisu, how do I know that? Because look at the next part, the second stick. Yasisu ki yimtu kaver. When will they be happy? When they find their grave. When they get buried. Legever asher darko nistara. Now here it gets sharp against God. Which person is the person who begs for death? Legever asher darko nistara. That his path has been hidden from him. Obviously, he's referring to himself, and who's the one who's hidden his path? God. Vayasech Eloha Be'ado. And here he says it specifically. Vayasech is to take stones. When you block up a path, that's called Vayasech. Vayasech Eloha Ba'ado. And God has poured stones onto his path, which means, you did this to me, and now I want to die. And it's not fair.
See,
and that was
inflation is nothing like that.
What does he say? What does he say?
Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden and from whom God has screened himself?
And God has screened him. Right, when you put stones, it comes with the idea that, it has screened himself?
Yeah.
Oh, I would have said...
Oh, but
himself
is... God has God.
The
himself is not capitalized.
Oh, so himself is wrong. It should be God has screened him.
Well,
and that comes to the idea of the stones. What you used to do is you used to put stones in the path to keep you from getting there. That's the idea of Vayasa. Go ahead.
To the man who has lost his way, whom God has hedged about.
Hedge, right. Again, the hedge, the headstones.
Yeah,
that's right.
You have the same one as I do.
Yeah.
But what you clearly have, though, is, and it's interesting, by the way, in Chaf Gimel, in the first stick of Chaf Gimel, it's in the passive. L'gevra asher darko nistara. It was hidden. It doesn't say who, right? It's like when you have an evative re. So we say evan nimkar be'avodat be'gnevato. So Chazal say, what's the problem with Nimkar? You don't know who the agent is. Who sold him? Who's selling him? So Chazal say, who sells him when you steal something? It's Beit Din that has to sell him. As opposed to the other kind of evidivri who loses money and who sells him? Atzmo. Who mocheret atzmo. The problem with the passive in Hebrew is you never know who did it.
Mm.
And that's intentionally. Somebody whose path was hidden. Maybe it was God, maybe it was me, I'm not saying. And now, after I finish with the first stick, I'll tell you who I think it is. I'll tell you who stuck my path up. It was God. And that's why I'm crying out for pain. Let's just read the last two lines, which may be the most, some of the most beautiful in Tanakh. Before I could put food in my mouth, my sighs come. And next time we'll do this Tehillim, because he quotes from this Tehillim, and we'll do a comparison. And my shagotai and my cries, the lion's roars, they melt like water, which means they pour in. It's like you have to sense this screaming in pain. He's in pain, by the way. It's important to remember that. He's really screaming in pain. It's a person of immense suffering. And now these two lines are unbelievable. I was afraid, and it came. Vasher yagorti, and that which I feared, yavoli. Lo shalavti, I could not get rest. Lo shakatati, I could not be quiet. Velo nachni, I did not get rest. Vayavo roges, and the pain or the sins came, and the troubles came. Although remember, the word roges was used by the sinners before. So the question is, does he mean pain or does he mean sin? That's the whole idea. Does he feel that it's a sin that his troubles are coming? That's the game he's playing. I don't know if he's accusing God or if he's accusing the other people or if he's accusing himself. It's hard to say. But the idea of troubles and sin are together. But here I want to focus on those last two lines and I'll stop. Kipachat pachadati v'yetayeni. What does that mean? I was afraid of fear and it came. What does that really mean? In English, how would you translate that? I knew it was going to come. I knew it was going to come. And you know what? I was a worrywart, and sure enough, it came. What is he probably referring to? You remember his children, at the end of the ceremony, he would always, at the end of 7 days, he would bring sacrifice because he knew something was going to happen. I was afraid. I knew it. I knew something was going to happen. Or he may just be describing himself. He's a worrywart. And all the happiness and goodness he has, it gives him a little sense of his personality. He's not a happy-go-lucky person. It's not like now he's sad before he was happy. He describes himself, he lets it slip. Kipachad b'chadati, I knew I was afraid. Vayet tayeni, and it came. That's an Aramaic word. Ati is to come. Vayet tayeni. Vasher yagorti, and that which I was afraid of, yavoli, it came just like I knew it would. Lo shalati, I never got rest. Velo shakatani, I could not be quiet. Velo nachti, I didn't get a night's sleep. Vayavro roges, and the pain I knew was coming, I knew was coming. Gives you an interesting view of his personality. He's not the super happy-go-lucky we thought he is. He's a worrier. He's a guy who was always afraid that something was going to happen, and in fact it did.
It sounds like all the mitzvot that he did were just sort of to
offset
what
he
said.
From his whole heart, it was done in order to protect him.
Well, certainly the sacrifices he does for his child. Again, here's a tough line. There are three levels. There's tzaddik, there's rasha, and there's a guy who never does anything wrong and doesn't deserve to be punished. Whether he's a tzaddik, he's not a rasha. That he states unequivocally, and the Torah states it. U'tam v'yashar v'yirei Elohim. The truth is, that's a good point. If it wasn't for the author has to be careful about describing Eov in the first chapter Because otherwise we're not so sure. If it's just the stories, he's got his friends accusing you, he's telling him about a water war. The chapters in the beginning are necessary to tell you that he is a totally righteous guy. But righteous is one thing, but being worried about it is another. I could be righteous and be a worry wart, but he certainly is a worry wart. He certainly is a worry wart. At least that's how I think it takes a look. And it's a beautiful line. Kipachad pachadati vayetayeni, asher yagorti yavoli, lo shalavti, lo shakadati, lo nachti, vayavo roges. And then it came. You know what I always think of? Anybody read, I'm sorry, I know we're going late, just want to finish with this idea. That last line, shalavti, lo shalavti, lo nachti, pause, vayavo roges. It always reminds me of All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
You ever read? And the last line is, and the rain came. Right, right. And it's this powerful, that was that famous Hemingway, these short sentences that were like they would just drive into you. So it's after she dies, right? And he's looking out the window, he's in Switzerland, and he goes, and then the rain came. And that, so whenever I read this, I think of the power,
it should be the other way around.
I know, unfortunately I read Hemingway first, but that's what you should get here. Lo nachti, lo shalavti, lo shakati, lo nachti, Yavo Roges, and the rain came. And that's exactly you should think Hemingway, or vice versa. When you read Hemingway, you should think E.O. But this author is unbelievable. He was doing Hemingway thousands of years before Hemingway ever did Hemingway. So here it is, right here.